I was thinking about our discussion yesterday, and one thought came up, which is about the fear of rejection. Being rejected by those we love. I would consider this to be a primal fear, because it threatens our very existence. Now, if we look at this in an objective way, the baby is not afraid of not being loved, because the ego has not set in. There is no fear of rejection as far as the baby is concerned. Even for a child, it's still a concept which does not really operate. But when the ego starts setting in, and identification happens, the closest we identify with is our family, because they are physically around us. So the ego holds the family most dear. Now, this baby is always receiving love because it's a baby. The baby is being itself, nothing more than that. The consciousness is too fresh in the baby. So it is being. Then the household, the parents, start giving love to the baby. So the first source of love is the parents. If they are siblings, then the siblings start giving it. Now, what has happened is, love was being showered on the baby. With the setting in of the ego thinks it is being loved. And then the ego wants more and more of that love. Now let's say a baby, a very young child, is running around the house. Parents, friends come. Baby is pretty open. It will run to anyone who calls it or who, you know, is nice to it. There's no separation yet. Which means that child consciousness is not seeking love. That is what is developing by and by. And so if one family member stops giving love, the ego feels rejected. What does it mean that the ego feels rejected? It means I don't exist. I started out this retreat by saying everything is the fear of death, which sounds unbelievable, but we can keep coming back to it. If the nearest and dearest ones stop giving me love, I feel rejected. If I am rejected, it means I no longer exist for them, which means I will die. What will happen to me without their love? It's all very natural how this operates. Just understanding is required. So children who are unloved by parents go through this. Those children who are fortunate to be loved by the parents, they don't go through this. Then life takes its course. It could be that the child is loved by the parents, but as the child grows into being a youth, the youth finds that my friends don't love me. And so on and so forth, different destinies play out as far as this issue is concerned. Or we will find a child who was not loved by the parents works very hard to make friends, lots of friends, so that that love can compensate for the lack of love from the parents. That also happens. That is how the ego operates. Then there is a child who is rejected by the parents or siblings and is not of the nature to make friends. Maybe quiet, introverted. And as such, is dealt a difficult hand of cards. That is why I have started in my recent talks talking about how death and love are so closely interconnected. So the understanding is, rather than moping and complaining and fretting and drowning in one's sorrows, to just give little time to understand, what is this about? Why am I feeling this? What does it show? And we find all the layers getting peeled off one by one. And in the process, we ignore that one true love, which is the love of God. Not as an entity. The pure presence which has been with me from day one is love. Always ever there. The formless presence, formless consciousness has been taken for granted. Not relevant enough for me because I am consumed by me and my story, which I find most relevant, which is the ego talking. And then this ego, imbued with a sense of doership, has people in life to blame. This person is behaving with me like this. That person is not behaving that way. That family member is fine. The other one is behaving like this. That is the ego with its sense of doership, either attributing it to someone else or to itself. Then that becomes the story of life, which is the story of suffering. Be happy. Go on moping. Go on fretting. There will be no end to that. Because the other person is not going to change. It is your attitude, your perspective. When that shifts, one stops making demands on people to be loved, and one finds that when the spotlight moves from me, I am the one who should be loved. When I turn it around, to face the other, I find that I myself become more and more loving. Can you imagine? Just try. The person who you feel should love you and doesn't love you. Just imagine. I am that person right now. You can place their image upon me, whatever. In your mind, you can think I am there and place their image on me. I am that person. And now you are telling me you know what? If I was in your shoes, maybe I would feel the same way about me as you are. If I was in your shoes, I don't know. I am that person. And you are telling me, if I was in your shoes, maybe I would feel the same way about me. I don't know. Who knows? Because you are seeing me through your filters. It's very hard. But now one possibility has opened up. That this person, who is not giving me the love I feel they should have given, may be right from their point of view, which I will never know, because I can only see the relationship from my point of view. That is how limited my vision is. Now, thereafter, what happens? The person who is feeling rejected, when this new understanding starts seeping in, and the ego realizes, let me now take attention away from collecting love and let me start giving it. Giving it how? I don't have to be expressive. I don't have to hug everyone. I don't have to say sweet, sweet words. That is all on the surface. I just have to accept the other, which is the opposite of reject. The opposite of reject is accept. When I accept someone, including the one who is withholding love from me, when I accept them for the way God made them, that is true love. Because I have now got no conditions on that person. Absolutely none. That is all. Just the acceptance is enough. Because I have accepted God's creation the way God has made it. Isn't that true love? I have allowed the other person to be an expression of God, just as I am an expression of God. So the whole focus now shifts from rejection to acceptance. And I find when I start accepting people more and more for who they are, I start accepting myself more and more for who I am. That is the law of the cosmos. As within, so without. I start accepting myself more and more. Which means, I start loving myself more and more. So what happens is earlier my consciousness was full of rejection. Now it is full of acceptance. Acceptance becomes the content of my consciousness. Acceptance of what is, acceptance of people the way they are, the way God created them, which means an acceptance of the will of God. Which means I am now with the one which is my one true love, which is pure presence and being, which I forgot about conveniently. Can we really be grateful and appreciative of this presence which is right here, right now, which has never left us. People have left us. Individuals have left us. Has the presence left us? And we ignore it. We take it for granted. How would the presence feel if it was a person? Bloody hell, I'm with you throughout and you don't look at me. You don't acknowledge me. You forget about me. But it is so compassionate. It is here right now with you, no matter what you did to it.
So we keep rejecting ourselves.
One sec. That presence you ignored because it would not say anything to you. It doesn't speak. Whereas you are too used to people doing things and saying things. So who is it that will never reject you in life? There is no guarantee as far as any individual is concerned. We can say God, consciousness, presence, call it what you will. Sounds very impersonal. Arey, there is no person here. But that no person is your guarantee. The sage knows this. Sounds cold, maybe. But there is a realization here. There is an acknowledgement of that presence which got covered because of my suffering. Now, what comes closest to that presence? And that is the Guru. Why? Because the Guru-disciple relationship is not a family relationship. You are not born into it karmically in that sense. And the Guru wants nothing from you. The Guru wants nothing from you, but rather accepts you the way God has made you. Who else in your life will accept you like that? All your friends will tell you what you should and should not do, how you should behave, how you should not behave, and most likely talk behind your back, especially the ones you think will not. That is human nature. In the guru-disciple relationship, this dynamic does not operate. Because what the guru is giving is only his presence. The guru can only want your well-being. Because the guru has seen life, seen its ups and downs, seen the challenges. And when someone is going through that, when the Guru sees how people trip on themselves, how they fall, and the Guru just expresses, hey, look here, consider things this way, look at things this way. That is unconditional love. No conditions attached. If there are conditions attached, then that is not a guru-disciple relationship. Now, more importantly, the guru is a form, like any form. Friend, spouse, parent, child are all forms. Guru is also a form. But there is one difference. The Guru is nothing else but the higher self of the disciple projected onto the form. It appears as a separate person. But look how compassionate God is. Through your suffering, through all your trials and tribulations, you hear something, you read something, someone mentions some name. And you say, let me explore what this is about. And something touches you. Maybe what the person has said, maybe anything. Just how someone looks. When that happens, there's no mask you are wearing. Otherwise, tomorrow you go to dinner with some friends, meet new people, you're all wearing masks. You're going to project your best self out there so that you are liked. That does not operate in this relationship because you have no need to wear a mask, nor does the guru have a need to wear the mask. But then you find, are, isne ye baat boli, so interesting. Or you find, this guy doesn't make sense, but you're still intrigued. Because he is talking about life, living. What is it about? What you don't realize is it is your own higher self talking back to you. So that guru is nothing but consciousness. What we tend to do is venerate the form. Put garlands, do tikka, do this, do that, which is fine. But this realization is that the guru is consciousness shining its light back onto the disciple. And therefore, there is no separation between the two. As far as the guru is concerned, consciousness cannot see separation. And more importantly, guru-disciple relationships are predetermined, like everything else. You may think you are choosing a guru. It doesn't work like that. Because if that happens, you might be choosing gurus all your life. Because there is a sense of doership now involved. Gurus happen. They happen. Sometimes people know it instantly. This one is my guru. Sometimes it takes time. One cannot have 5 gurus at the same time. Because that means there are 5 higher selves. Doesn't work like that. So to say no one is my guru and I have 5 people I listen to, that is fine. And if you feel you don't need a guru, that works best for you, that there are 5 sources of guidance which appeal to you, or 10 or 15. Then your destiny is not to have a guru, which is also fine. It is not everyone's destiny to need a guru or have a guru. But if one is on the spiritual journey and one has 5 teachings, 10 teachings, teachers to access, and one feels we don't need all this but we enjoy it, that is fine, provided you are at peace. The one who is at peace does not need a guru. And it is not necessary to have a guru to get the peace. But it is more probable. It is more likely. That is the difference. Probability and more likely. Because otherwise, all my life I can be immersed in wisdom teachings, and everything adds value to my understanding. But there is not going to be that one place I call home. When I would visit my teacher, I would still meet many masters, many yogis. I enjoyed meeting them. But I found every Sunday I was back at his door. I learned a lot from many people. And somehow, circumstances made it very easy for me to meet gurus who had big followings. Somehow it happened. Gurus whose followings were 1,000 times more than my gurus. It was very easy. But yet I found, as my friend Gabriel would say, because when I met Ramesh, he was 83 years old. Till the age of 92, I was with him when he passed on. And he said, God came in the most unassuming form of an 83-year-old grandpa wearing a white kurta pajama who would sit every morning in his rocking chair and tell people from all the world, all over the world, all there is the will of God. And all there is consciousness. Bas. It was very easy to stray from this message because I heard fascinating stories, fascinating tales. I used to be so taken up by the things these yogis, masters of different traditions would tell me. But deep down, I knew I had to live my life day by day. That yogi is not going to live my life. I have to live it. And it could have created a lot of confusion. Once I sat with a yogi who told me, okay, now I'll put you in the no mind state, unmani avastha. Now I'll put you in this state and that state. So I sat thinking that this is really amazing, you know, the yogi just does it that way. But I was in the same state. And then he told me, now you've gone from this state to that state and this state to that state. I was more confused because I felt I was in the same state. I have had very strange encounters. I once went to there was one man from the US who's now very popular in the US. He had come for a talk in Bombay. And he believed in a deity in South India called Mookambika Ma. So there's a medium who gets the energy of the Devi and then gives messages to people. So that messenger was in Bombay. He was called to Bombay and you could take appointments and meet him. So he told me, Gautam, you don't miss this opportunity. The Divine Mother will guide you. I said, of course. And I was in South Bombay. That man was in South Bombay. So I went. So he spoke only, what is the language of that state? Anyway, South Indian language. And there was an English doctor who was the interpreter. So he said, what do you want? And I thought about it and I said, I want Nirvikalp Samadhi. Acha? He said, come, aajao, bet. So I sat. Wow, I'm going to get Nirvikalp Samadhi. So then he pressed me very hard here, very hard. Ho gaya? I said, kidhar ho gaya? Acha? Then he pressed me here. I said, Baba, kuch nahi hua. Then he pressed me here and then suddenly, he said, aapka kaam pichle janam mein ho gaya, abhi niklo idhar se. How convenient. Pichle janam mein ho gaya. Then I realized, this is not my path. This path of experiences and all these things. Theek hai ya. Even if they are there, big deal, what will I do with the Nirvikalp Samadhi? But by and by, every day, let what comes come. Let what goes go. His famous words. Let what comes come. Let what goes go. Don't try to hold on to it. Easier said than done, no doubt. But you are increasing your suffering. Your own suffering. Let what comes come, let what goes go, and see what remains. What remains? Presence, being, awareness, consciousness. Very simple. No experience of presence. But everyone wants that experience. Shaktipat. Can you handle it? Are you an eligible candidate for Shaktipat? I know someone who went to a very famous master who is no more and who was giving Shaktipat, and for 2 years this boy had unimaginable pain in his groin area which no doctor could solve. Why? Kundalini rose, got stuck in the Svadhisthan chakra because he was not ready. That is why teachings and techniques which first deal with the descending energy, as my mother says in her classes, first let your vision clear up, let your buddhi clear up, so that when the energy rises, it does not meet all these blocks. But we want that experience. U.G. Krishnamurti had gone to Ramana Maharshi and said, I want what you have. I want what you have. And Ramana Maharshi replied, but can you take it? One boy went to Ramana Maharshi and said, just like Ramakrishna bestowed his blessings on Vivekananda, I want you to bestow your blessings on me. And Ramana Maharshi replied, so are you saying you are a Vivekananda? And that boy got up and ran away. So better that a teaching which is like a small ivy cut prick, slowly, slowly, goes into your blood. You don't even feel it. And your consciousness is now evolving and changing, opening different perspectives, different ways of seeing situations, seeing people, dheere, 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 gently. And then you say, my God, 1 year ago, I thought so differently compared to today. 1 year ago, compared to today, I'm so much more at peace with myself, with others, and with what happens in my life. I consider this a blessing. then maybe on my last day, there may be tears, but also a smile when it's time to leave. कि ठीक है, ये सब भी देखना ही था. And I learned from it all. Thy will be done. My Sufi mentor gets many people, not just for the teachings, but for his remedies and family problems, ye wo, whatever. And he says, whoever enters my room, the first thing I tell myself, this person is better than me. Someone of his stature, because all sorts of people go to him. Once I was sitting with him, next to him, and one man walked in who was filthy and smelly, and he came, and rather than talking from the front, came and sat next to me. And the Baba was here, the man sat here, and I just closed my eyes. Smelly, filthy, dirty. And they started talking to each other. And the Baba was telling him, now you go from here. Come later, go. And he was not going. Then I heard one, two galis, which are universal in language. And the man got up and ran. But immediately the Baba got up, followed him down the steps and came back up. I said, kya hua, Baba? He said, aise hi wo jata tha, nahi to nahi jata, lekin maine jeb mein paise dal diye. Such is the compassion. Now, can you imagine if someone comes to you dirty and filthy and smelly, and your first thought is, this person has better qualities than me. And he would say, it doesn't mean I'm a fool. I know. It doesn't make me a fool to think that. So by and by we find we are gentler with people we meet, and we are gentler on ourselves. We are gentler on those who have troubled us. It's okay to be gentle with them. You don't have to emulate the person who's troubling you, no matter how much the ego likes it. It's not a written law. Yes, Sheeta.
Started this conversation, you said, accepting the one will, withholding love from me is love as well. Something like that.
Sorry?
So you, one of the statements you said was accepting the one who is withholding love from me is love.
Yes.
I look for reciprocation, something in return, a give and take. Is that just because of the conditioning?
Yes, you could say that. Give and take. You know, we even do it. I have seen this with friends on birthdays. If a friend gives a gift of a certain value, you want to give a gift of that kind of value.
Yeah.
Give and take.
How do you get to a place of just accepting people and loving them without expectations of getting any love back in return?
This is what we've been talking about since the start of the retreat and till the end of the retreat. That's how we'll approach it from various dimensions.
So then slowly, slowly with practice it'll happen.
One could say that, if it appeals to one. It could be that you leave this retreat and say, this was not for me. Right? Even that is a possibility. That I don't buy this. I think give and take as a model works very well for me. And I only want to give from where I get also. Could also be.
Obviously, before this retreat, that is where I was coming from. And then I have seen in relationships that I am more giving than the other. And then I start feeling used in those relationships.
Maybe. Now the point is, you have to see in which relationship. Is it a problem to be used, or are you okay being used? And in which relationships you feel, no, maybe I'm not okay.
My ego doesn't like being used.
Which ego likes being used?
Yeah, so it's all about the ego which I...
So try to be used and enjoy being used once at least. And it will be quite liberating. All right, chalo, use me. Just try it. It's really liberating.
I will have to. The other thing that you were saying, I think when I interrupted you, what I was thinking about is I keep looking for this acceptance and love from other people.
Exactly.
Then I have to really just look for the one who's with me all the time. That's me or my consciousness or the God.
No, so I'm turning this around. Why not start accepting other people rather than looking for acceptance from other people? When we stop looking for acceptance and start accepting people, it will automatically happen. I won't even have to accept myself anymore. It will happen.
Shift the focus, basically.
Yes. Shift the focus from looking for acceptance to accepting others.
But again, that got established or got learned by conditioning from the childhood.
Obviously.
So again, you're undoing what you've learned up until now.
This is now fresh conditioning. Two things could have happened. Either you would have continued with your earlier conditioning.
Where the suffering was more.
Or you come across something like this or anything else, vipassana, yeva, whatever it be, which provides fresh conditioning. And then you start viewing life through the fresh conditioning. And if that fresh conditioning impacts you, it starts overriding the earlier conditioning.
So by default, the old conditioning kicks in.
It is there. So yes.
The other one has to be a correction conscious mode that kicks in, which eventually will take over.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Samjhi.
There will be a flip-flop. Sometimes you'll react based on old conditioning because it's hardwired into you.
Right.
Sometimes the teaching will reveal itself while some event is happening and say, wow, you know. So you'll go through that process, which is the flip-flop. Then by and by you find that you are more now operating from the new conditioning.
Got it.
Till that becomes the default conditioning.
Right.
If it is meant to happen. If. You know, Joel Goldsmith said, the two greatest words in the English dictionary are the words as and is. As and is. So, for example, God appearing as individuals, God appearing as what is, as is. So, if today I get a call and whatever the person says pains me, God appearing as the call which I received, as, not was, not will. As it is. What is right here, right now. Not the past, not the future. Because both these words belong to the present moment. The rest is conjecture. That is why the acceptance of what is. God appearing as the other, whoever the other may be. Anyone else would like to share anything? If you have more questions.
I do. So, I woke up this morning with the question that we keep talking about God, but did any of these previous gurus, your guru and his guru, have any certain form of deity that they thought of as God? Because God includes all kind of, all supreme powers, which is one and call what you meant.
Right. So this lineage, this parampara, refers to the formless God, consciousness. This path of Advaita is the path, you could say, of, which is the path of knowledge, of jnana, where the underlying principle is the Mahavakyas of the Vedas, one of which is consciousness is all there is. In terms of tradition, for example, Ramesh Balsekar from the family Saraswat Brahmin, which he came, they of course had a deity. Mangeshwar is the name, which is a form of Shiva from their region.
Okay.
But the parampara is of Brahman, consciousness. That is how the teaching got delivered. Now, in the lineage, as I was saying yesterday, expressions have been different. Like Siddharameshwar Maharaj's Guru Bhau Sahib Maharaj used to give mantra diksha.
Right.
And he emphasized japa. Siddharameshwar Maharaj, as a disciple, used to go into these long bouts of inquiry and meditation, and he discovered a what he called a faster way. And he therefore got classified. So his guru's teaching was called the ant's way, and his teaching got called the bird's way.
Right.
Now, his disciple Nisargadatta Maharaj, while imbibing all that, had his own take of delivering the teaching. So his tenet was, you are not the body. Now anyone who would come to him, his teaching was the same. You are the I am, the abiding principle. Some people got it in a flash. Consciousness talking to consciousness. Other egos got confused. Now, Ramesh was his disciple. Ramesh was one of the translators of Maharaj. Ramesh, being a banker, studied at the London School of Economics, was a very rational man. A man from urban India and well-educated. As the translator, he realized he would rather talk to the ego rather than say, you're not the body. So while the teachings are the same, the delivery is different through the generations. And that is how it happens. It's not that the teaching is evolving or taking a different direction. It is delivering in a different way the same message. If that did not happen, it would be a dead teaching.
Right.
Here it is evolving.
So it's fitting its audience.
Which is meant to hear it.
Right.
Which we don't know. We don't know. That is like a divine play out there.
Right.
You know, so it's all very strange in a way, but that is how it flows. Like, now in my case, I became a mixed bag. Because I had an Advaita Guru, I had a mother who herself is a master who has the Kundalini approach. And whenever someone would present Rameshji with a question on Kundalini, he would say, it's not my experience, please go to Gautam's mother. It's not my domain.
Okay.
So I was able to imbibe a lot of knowledge on the path of Kundalini, Chakra, subtle body, because that was the dominant conversation at home and on the dining table.
Right.
Plus meeting all the people who would visit her. So I got that conditioning. Then I got the full Advaita conditioning, because 10 years is not a short time.
Right.
10 years of going to the same place. Then I found some exposure to the Sufi tradition. Then I found some exposure to the Navnats, which is a kind of a tradition of 9 eternal beings, one could say, which is very well known in the rural centers of West India and in the hills of North India. I found I was always being taken to the Navnats and drawn to them. So all these became my influences, but my home was Advaita. So the way the teaching is coming out through me is perhaps colored very differently, yet the same.
Yeah.
Because I will not hesitate to talk about the subtle body if the need arises, whereas my teacher will never go into it. So I don't tell myself, because he didn't, I shouldn't. That would be a disservice to my conditioning. Whatever is of help to the person in front of me somehow comes forth, because it is not coming from the mind. It just, whatever has to be said is said, and what has to be said is perhaps based on this whole pot. So that is my understanding of how the delivery changes. Now my teacher loved talking. Like even if you went and met him one-on-one for chai, he would not talk. He would not sit, like Eckhart would probably just sit. My teacher was the opposite. He would want to engage. What's happening? What happened at work? What did you do in the morning? So you had to keep answering. That was his nature. My nature is not that. If someone comes and sits with me, then I will not want to talk if that person is not talking. Or I will talk less. So it's all very different.
One more question. So, you know, before this retreat, our sufferings and our experiences, however God willed it, has changed the original being that I was born as, which probably my mom identifies with the most. She comments here and there that, and my mom probably means the most to me, so I take everything she says super seriously. So mom has commented, you know, why are you letting their meanness change your niceness? Then I feel I was so protected and sheltered, maybe I am taking this as being street smart now, or not letting people who are used me, which I'm not enjoying, to not let them use me. So like she thinks my negative experiences, which I think have helped me grow and change, according to her, have ruined me in terms of taking away that niceness. So I tell her, well, you know, this is who I am. This is the evolved person. But so you think now with following or slowly with these changes, that original stuff will come back? Original niceness?
Now, this is a very important point. Sheetal had a friend who would wish her happy birthday every year. For 15 years. And then 1 year didn't wish Sheetal. Now, let us find out what is that original niceness. This friend didn't wish Sheetal this year. Now the friend's birthday is coming up in 2 months. If the originally nice Sheetal genuinely felt for her friend, she would not hesitate wishing the friend on her birthday.
Right.
The hurt would be there. You didn't remember my birthday. But it would not stop that originally nice Sheetal from wishing. At some point, Sheetal may tell her friend, "Hey, you missed my birthday." Maybe.
Right.
Now Sheetal may feel, it's a give and take, man. You didn't wish me, I don't wish you. Which means Sheetal has lost her niceness. Because life has become give and take. Now there's another dimension. What if originally Sheetal didn't ascribe any value to birthdays? Would she not be nice by not wishing? You see,
right.
Now these only you will know.
Right.
So in one sense, your mother is right. That if the mother has seen the child consciousness and the young consciousness, which was more open, expressive and giver, now sees that due to learnings in life, this child has made all these boundary walls now.
Right.
Which is what the ego does. Builds up these barriers. It happens. I know people, if a friend upsets them, they block them on WhatsApp. Boundary. I am creating my boundaries with this friend. The ego is trying to protect itself. Why? I don't want to die.
Right.
Therefore, boundary as protection. Being used means what, Sheetal? What is it being? Kya fayda? Paisa le raha hai, I understand. So tangible.
Say you go for dinner and every time you are only paying.
So you have to look at that. Are you fulfilling a need? Why am I the only one paying? I agree with you. Fayda uthaya. Now, you have to decide. If this other person is as affluent as I am, maybe they need to pay once in a while at least. Because even that much awareness must come.
Right.
But if Sheetal is afraid that if I don't pay for the next meal, maybe she will not like me anymore.
Or I will lose her as a friend.
Then you will keep paying. And this comes up very often, this thing, what you mentioned. And you will find that the person who is paying, the need is theirs.
The person who is paying, the need is theirs.
Yeah. Now, because this is a very rational situation.
Right.
Where you can say, I'm being used because I'm paying all the time. Now, one is Sheetal doesn't mind paying all the time because she has enough money, no problem. But Sheetal has to ask herself, is there any fear which is making me pay all the time?
Maybe it's again all about acceptance. You want to be accepted.
Yes. Yes. So the fear is, if I don't pay, will my friend stop calling me? We normally buy our relationships.
Again, that would be death of ego, right?
100%.
Okay, a time I tell her to pay and the next time she just doesn't agree for a dinner together.
Yes. Now, but this time Sheetal will express herself in a different way. Out of compassion, she will tell her friend that, hey, you know, if you don't mind, I'd like to share my feelings with you on this. That I've been happy to take you out all the time. But I would also like it if sometime you took me out. Sheetal will not target her guns on her friend. Arey, every time I am paying, what the hell, why don't you pay sometime? You see, the language changes.
It's all about delivery here as well.
It happens that way. It happens that way because, first of all, Sheetal knows that there must be some reason my friend is not paying. I don't know what it is. X, Y, Z, A, B, C. I don't want to get into that. But maybe she'll say something which I may say, oh, I didn't think of this. Maybe. Because Sheetal is now open. So when Sheetal is expressing herself, she finds that expression is not against someone. It is more embracing, more compassionate. And by all means, if I was in your place, I would mention it. or I would not mention it and stop taking that person out till that person called me and said, hey, I'd like to take you out. But any pattern we are repeating, if it is looked at, it reveals the fears of the ego. If I don't pay for all meals, I will be perceived as not being a nice person. So I will buy my way through paying for all the meals. Now, Sheetal may take a friend who she knows does not have the kind of money she has and will not think of going to those restaurants. Then Sheetal will happily take that friend because there's joy. I'm giving my friend who can't afford these meals, and I'll happily take her once a month because I love doing it. I enjoy doing it. That's a different thing. Sheetal is not going to say, "Arey," because Sheetal knows this person can't afford these lunches. It's very hard. It's okay.
Right.
So that is on a relationship to relationship basis. And we will reveal to ourselves where our fears are lying. If you start building boundaries, which is what the ego does, it is only going to build boundaries after boundaries after boundaries after boundaries. And God says, hey, I'm on the other side. What have you gone and done?
Then you said about the delivery of message from the same lineage being different as well. That can sometimes feel very, like for example, Maharaj, let's talk about the absolute. He wouldn't talk much about relationships and stuff.
Yes.
But it's the same message as, say, peace of mind through relationships.
Mm.
But it can appear very different.
Mm.
And it's said in a very different way.
Yes.
Right? So, can that create like a little bit of a khichdi situation when you're like listening to someone who's talking about peace of mind through relationships versus say Maharaj just pointing at the absolute? And is it prudent to sort of stick to one even though it's the same lineage?
If it is creating khichdi, yes, it is prudent to stick to one. For me, it didn't create khichdi. I'll tell you how. I realized that Rameshji's teaching was geared to annihilate the thinking mind. Right? Peace of mind through relationships. Everyone is operating on their genetics and conditioning which God made. That was his teaching. And acceptance of the will of God. So the annihilation of the thinking mind, which was blaming, condemning, hating, judging, full of ill will, spite and all that, all gone. What was left was Maharaj's abide in your being.
Yeah, no, it's the same thing, but it's said very differently.
Yes, so an ego which is not able to see this or contemplate enough upon it to realize it's the same could get confused.
Yeah, so if there's a recognition of both being the same but yet different,
yes.
So does one do what resonates with them personally? Like say this message resonates more, so stick to that.
If it's the same parampara, there's no problem in that sense because, as I say, the stream is the same. But it is impossible to abide in your being as a constant state if you are not having peace of mind. Because otherwise, you'll keep trying to abide in your being and your relationships are a mess. So it'll never happen. Because then abide in your being will be for some duration of time. Mm-hmm. Till the world takes over, your relationships take over, and then your presence and peace of mind is all gone. But by and by, I find that the more and more my thinking mind is not working and is disengaged, which is like a default setting now, I am abiding in being. So I need to expend no effort to be in the I am or abide in being because that has become the natural state. So I, in fact, got influenced by Siddharameshwar Maharaj a lot also. But for me, I didn't find that they were different things.
No, they're the same. But yeah. They'd be so different.
Yeah, some people, of course. Some people can get confused. Like I said, some people did. Maharaj said, you're not the body.
Yeah. Exactly.
And they would say, hello.
Yeah.
You know, whereas some people got it.
Yeah.
But some people think they have got it. They think they have got it. Therefore, my teacher said, the acid test is daily living. That is the acid test. That is why the emphasis on daily living.
Like, for example, I was reading pointers from Nisargadatta Maharaj on the plane, and you know, one of the pointers was there is no you or there is no me, and understanding that is enlightenment.
Yes.
And there is no enlightenment.
Hmm.
That's what he said.
Mm.
But like when like somebody would ask Ramesh what's enlightenment, he would sort of say, he would go on the non-doership angle and you're not the doer, and recognition of that is enlightenment.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, there is no you and there is no me is what Ramesh would also say. How?
Because everyone's will of God.
One sec. Correct. If there is no other to hate, forget love, it's too complicated. If there is no other to hate, it means there is no other for me to hate. If there is no other for me to hate, it means there is no other. And if there is no other, there is no me apart from the other. And if there is no me apart from the other, then consciousness is all there is.
Yeah, but in this situation, I think Maharaj clearly said,
now,
there is no such thing as enlightenment.
One sec. When consciousness is all there is, what is left is peace of mind.
Yeah.
And that peace of mind is what Ramesh called enlightenment.
But Maharaj's delivery was different. He said there is no such thing as enlightenment.
Obviously, because he was saying it in his context.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because he was trying to say enlightenment is not an experience.
Yeah. Correct.
So Ramesh brought it down to peace of mind. Is peace of mind an experience?
No, because words can be a bit tricky, you know?
Yes, because words are said in context.
Right. So that's why I'm asking, like, isn't it simpler to like just stick to what like goes in?
If one really hits home, then, like for me, I had no conflict with any words of Ramesh. But then I found it very easy to absorb Nisargadatta's teachings also, or Ramana Maharshi, because there was no confusion or conflict in that sense. But if you find that looking at other things is creating confusion because I am now cross-pollinating or comparing, I can fully understand, because that won't work.
Yeah. It's clearly the same message, but sometimes the delivery and the words can make it appear as if it's...
That is why I thank God that God took me straight to one door from which I never left.
Mm. No, even though it's the same lineage, it can be a bit, you know, it's not like one is going to...
Sure. You could find Maharaj and Ramesh contradicting each other.
Right.
But everything is said in context.
Yeah.
So imagine you are sitting in one satsang with Maharaj and he's talking to you. It will be very different from this satsang with Ramesh and he's talking to you. But then we are trying to cross them. But that is a great book. That is a book of a disciple who is so fresh, he's gone to the guru and starts making notes of what the guru said. It's very beautiful.
And it's really amazing how his delivery is, in his own way, is so different from, you know, his first books.
Yeah.
His satsangs, they come out so different.
Yeah. I find that is one of Rameshji's best books, Pointers from Nisargadatta Maharaj. It really makes it easier to understand Maharaj.
Because my personal sense is Maharaj really simplified it. He said, just abide in the being as long as you can. You know, how can it get simpler than that?
And I found Ramesh's was very simple.
Because there's no be this, be that, do this, do that, you know, watch this, watch that. It's just abide in your being.
But that abide in your being needs to result in harmonious relationships.
But that will automatically happen, right? Because being is all loving, unconditional love. So how can it not be otherwise?
Then we have to ask people who are following Maharaj's teachings whether they have sorted out this whole dimension of relationships.
Then they're not abiding in being, right?
Perhaps.
Because they're not unconditional love or whatever you want.
No, they may think I am abiding in my being while hating others. It could be.
So but in reality, they're not there. Because abiding in being has a different quality to it.
Yes, but in their reality, they are. Amazing.
Yeah. Because whenever you are in being, you can't help but be loved. Like, that's not something you even have to try. So it is like a...
Yes. I agree. But we have to ask ourselves, are we?
Why aren't we, rather?
We aren't holding on. I mean, we're not expecting it slips out. That's the problem. Like, it was there throughout. It would always be the state, right?
I've got many good book titles. One was Deep Down.
Deep Down.
And this It Slips Out is a nice book title. It slips out.
Deep down, it slips out.
Like my friend who was with me in Ramesh's time, he said, I'm going to write a book, the title of which is Nothing Works. I said, lovely title. He didn't write it, but lovely title for a book. Nothing works.
No, but when Maharaj said abide in the being as long as you can, did he mean that don't forget about your being as long
perhaps
as
you could say that, perhaps.
So it's just a remembrance, right?
And all the time remembrance, like the background.
Yeah.
Very hard. Because we get consumed by daily living and what's happening. And Maharaj was a big advocate for meditation. Ramesh was not. Because Ramesh said, your whole daily living is meditation. Let's look at that. Forget about meditation as a practice. Maharaj would say, meditate.
But for me, I think it helps to meditate because the daily living, like, it translates into daily living.
Absolutely.
How can it not, right?
It does.
So that's the better approach, right?
Which?
Like, meditating and then abiding in the being and then like looking at relationships and all that.
Yes, but for some people meditation sounds to be a punishment because they are not built to meditate. So then one will not tell them to meditate. You know, as it is, life is hard. I don't want to make it harder by saying meditate. You know, so it's different strokes for different folks. Only thing is, this teaching says, now at least see where your peace lies and then try to stay with it. Earlier we didn't know that also. We were taken up by phenomenality and forms and shapes and colors and all that. And this teaching says just recalibrate during the day. Just see where is your peace to be found.
So nothing can be taken as a direct instruction, right? Like, one has to like sort of see within their own internal compass to see what resonates, you know, and that's how one...
Not necessary. Not necessary.
Like from every, say if meditation resonates with me.
No, but if I follow the word of the Guru blindly, like if the Guru says everything is God's will and it just, I take it as the word of God,
yeah.
I have to do nothing else.
Yeah. But the nuances, like say the small little things where you have to still be...
Perhaps that is the processing and working itself out. But you see, normally the obstacles are the yes but, yes but, yes but.
Yeah.
taking the word of the master. Because you're not taking the word of the master, you're taking the word of the source. Then it's not a yes but working it out, seeing how it works, seeing how it operates. That is why in one of Ramesh's German retreats, someone in the audience said, I feel I've wasted 3 days because at the end of it I got nothing, and he said, thank God. Nothing but peace of mind.
May I ask a question? Yeah. So many times these yogis go into an Nirvikalp Samadhi and they come back, the mind comes back. So you're not experiencing that Unmani Avastha, that Samadhi. Could it be you were already in Sahaja Samadhi, so what's the need of Nirvikalpa when you're always in being? Why come in, go out, come in, go out? Like Brahman.
I agree completely. Like Maharaj would say, even waking up and going to sleep is too much doership. It's too much coming, going, coming, going, coming, going.
Ramana hardly closed his eyes. He was always there.
There is one saying, though, the sage feels that even blinking of an eye is too much doership.
Is it? I've not heard of that.
One of the texts.
But in that sense, finding results through peace of mind, through relationships, is also too much doership, right?
Not if it is too much doing, because for me it's more revealing. When it's just, as Ramesh would say, the seeing is the only doing necessary. It's just a constant seeing. You're just seeing and seeing in a new light, in a new light. It's, I don't consider that as doership. It is actually a seeing. You'll really see the same person who's been pushing your buttons, and you'll then see, Are this person is dancing their usual dance. You see it. And you really see it. It's nothing to do with me. I thought it was. But this person is just playing their own number on autopilot. That seeing is the only doing necessary, which I don't consider it as doership. I consider it as it just starts happening. The understanding makes that happen.
There's absolutely no indication of fixing
things. No, no.
Nothing at all.
There could be at, in a way of like, first intellectually I got to say, oh, you know, this person is doing this now and this person's not the doer, for example. I go through that because my new conditioning is still to kick in, and acha, this fellow said that, you know, this guy is playing out their script. So I go through that process maybe, but by and by, I don't need to because I've started seeing it that way. So yes, you could say that is doership, but then even who am I is doership if you have to ask who am I all the time.
That's a pointer, no?
Exactly. So that's why when Ramesh would say the only practice he suggested was personal investigation, where he would tell everyone, at the end of your day, sit for 15-20 minutes, have your coffee or your beer, look at the events which transpired in the day, choose any one where you think it was your action. Anyone. And then ask yourself, is it truly my action? Or did it depend on something which I heard, tasted, smelled, saw or touched, without which my action would not have happened? And you will come to the conclusion, it is not my action. So people would do it. People would sit next day in the hot seat and say, you know, I investigated and this is what I concluded. So they had to go through that. You could call it doership, that personal investigation, that little technique was there. I didn't have to do it because it was obvious to me. So,
let's say I'll put it in context. Let's say there's a situation that happened, okay, and you're upset with someone. And then the next day you realize that, you know, clearly none of us were the doers here. But the situation is still not fixed in that sense. It's not harmonious. Some element of work is required there to sort of, whatever, make it harmonious again.
Mm.
That would require doership from...
Yes, because that is the fresh conditioning making new actions happen.
Yeah. Of course. There will always be some doership involved, right?
Yes, but the whole point is that when we say the concept of non-doership has been understood, means you've understood the person is not the doer of their actions.
Right, but there would still be work.
But that is daily living.
Yeah.
I have to even work for a daily living, even that is doership. So that is doership.
Yeah.
We are talking of...
Yeah, yeah, that work would always be...
Of course. Of course.
It wouldn't like... Just the clear seeing would never untangle it also.
No, eventually it would. Eventually it would.
But it would still require something to happen in the middle, right?
As part of the process.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Yes. But for example, now... My thinking mind is not working if the same person is troubling me. I may still react, but even that reaction is so split second because the old conditioning is still there. But there's no involvement in the reaction. That can also happen. But there's no story after that.
I asked it because, you know, I read somewhere, like I don't know, it was the Maharaj or Ramana, one of them said, like, the pride in your being and all else will be taken care of. You know, so... Like, my understanding of that was, like, you know, in your being state, things resolve on its own. And there's no need of, like, intervening or working it out at all. So, is that a correct understanding?
No, and yes. Abide in your being and things resolve on their own means... If I am resting in being all the time, it doesn't mean another person won't have a problem with me. Because I am abiding in my being, it's not going to sort that out. It is going to sort out my reaction and response to them. And why is that so? Because if I am truly abiding in my being, I have risen above the mundane. So this reaction will not come if one is truly abiding in being, which is Jesus's my kingdom is not of this world. It's very difficult. Because you see, today you've met someone who says abide in your being, but what about all your conditioning till today which you're operating on?
It keeps creeping up.
That is there. It's not easy.
Like, could they abide in being because of consistent practice? Or was it just the understanding that led to the continuous abiding?
Well, now Maharaj worked for... In 3 years, he got the enlightenment, what he speaks about. So it took 3 years for him. For someone else, some other master, it may have been the dark night of the soul, which lasted for a night or two. I don't know.
No, but like 3 years is 3 years of the understanding or 3 years of practice, say, which could be in the form of meditation?
We don't know, but he said it took 3 years. It could be the practice also.
Because the more you meditate, it does help to like sort of widen being right.
Sure.
Not one thing, I just want to know. I also want to understand. When the thinking mind is not there, then you are abiding in
thinking. Yes. Because you are not abiding in thinking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's... And can you just explain the difference between the working mind and the thinking mind?
So many videos are there on the working mind.
I mean, a little bit in a gist, if you
want. If you were working in your boutique and you were engaged in the work, that is the working mind being engaged. But if while you're working, your mind is drifting to all your problems, either udar, yevo, and you're not able to give 100% to your work, that is the thinking mind. The sage, because the thinking mind is absent, is either fully in the working mind when there is work, and when there is no work, the sage is witnessing. Why? Because there is no thinking mind. So the sage is witnessing. And when there's nothing to witness, the sage is non-witnessing. For example, I'm looking out of the window and I see cars going by. Witnessing is happening. Mera kya lena dena hai har gaadi ka? They are not mine. So I have no fear this one will have an accident, that one. So I'm witnessing the traffic go by. Now there are no more cars left. So when there's nothing to witness, there's non-witnessing. That is basically what it is, because the thinking mind is not operating. For us, what happens is we go back to the thinking mind when there's nothing else to do. We start thinking.
So non-witnessing is passive?
Yes.
It doesn't have objects in it?
Yeah, you could call it samadhi.
And witnessing is more like objects?
Witnessing is witnessing whatever is happening.
Does it have an element of effort to it?
Witnessing?
Yeah.
None. That is the ego walking in through the back door, saying, I will try and witness.
But what if the working mind is always active?
Many people do that, you know, to avoid the thinking mind.
Or to avoid abiding in being.
Normally, the working mind is always active because a person cannot handle the mind being vacant. There's fear there. Mm. It is not about abiding in being. You find people who are trying to be constantly engaged morning to night cannot handle a mind not working because there is fear. Now who am I? There's no work. So I must keep busy all the time. I must keep busy. Do this, do that, do this, do that. Which is still better than not engaging the working mind and just thinking mind is operating all the time. It's all relative. But to keep the working mind engaged all the time means I am afraid. Not of abiding and being in that sense, though I get your point, but I'm actually afraid of who am I without work. The work defines me. Normally, people who have an active thinking mind are encouraged to work. Even Ramesh would encourage them, you know, people who came to him with a lot of money, like an inheritance, and didn't have to work because they were thinking all the time of Advaita, this, that. An idle mind is a devil's workshop. Therefore, he would say, go and do social service maybe. Find out which are the NGOs in town and if it's your nature, kuch kaam karo. So that you're not always churning all the stuff in your mind. In that sense, better to be engaged in the working mind.
Is it also a disservice to tell someone to meditate when their working mind is always very active and by nature they need to do something? Like for example, my mother can't seem to sit still and meditate. And she always wants like some activity. But like I'll come and say, you know, sit, you know, get fine, sit, meditate and all that. And she doesn't like it at all. So like am I like, you know?
Yes, if you're...
From my point of view and saying like...
If you are constantly telling her, there is a problem. If you tell her once a while, Maji, thoda to baitho, 10 minute ke liye baitho na. 10 minute ke liye baitho, kya hoga? Kuch hoga nahi.
I'm wondering more, what would be appropriate for her? Like is that something, like you said, like Ramesh said to work. And she keeps looking for work. Like
no, but there is one thing here, Siddhan. If you find she is not at peace, there is no harm in suggesting it.
Yeah.
Because we come back to peace. Because then the intention is coming from there. You know, so there's no harm in that. It doesn't mean that because she's hardwired for working, let her be. Is she at peace? When the intention comes from there and say, okay, all right, you can do the work of 10 people perhaps. There are people like that who can really do a lot of work. But maybe take a break, just reflect and all. There's no harm in express. It's not that you're interfering in her blueprint that it's, you know. But if you find you are constantly berating her or telling her, then there's a problem. My understanding is people who are obsessed with work and know nothing else, who are not just able to be, even for a little time, is that they are perhaps at some level not at peace.
Because the fear of rejection is there when you're thinking.
The fear of rejection is there?
The fear of rejection. You want to only work because you don't want to think.
Correct.
So, because when you take out that time and you reflect back, all you feel is that.
Yes.
Rather than the family drama, the work is a better option.
Sure.
And also that fear of emptiness is like a misfounded fear, right? Because it's not actually bad. It's a peaceful state.
Yeah, but it's very scary for the ego.
Yeah.
Ego cannot fathom being empty.
What would amount to abiding as being, like looking at a mountain and saying, ah, what a beautiful mountain, or just being with the mountain without any thought whatsoever?
When one is abiding in being, everything is wow. Really? Time up? If you all feel I'm talking too much, I'd be more than happy to reduce the talking. Maybe tomorrow we can just sit in silence for 2 hours in the morning. And